out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network, a member of the Community Voices of NPR Illinois Springfield. And welcome to a full disclosure of a brand new film that just debuted on Netflix over the weekend. We're going to be talking all about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I'm Lou Hare, the Guilty Pleasures host. I'm stepping out of my Guilty Pleasures zone and actually getting to talk about a great film. So I'm always excited to talk about a movie that is not just ironically good, but good. So this is going to be fun. But I'm also excited to bring on two guests who we've never had on the podcast before, but I'm thrilled to have them in general on the show, but also particularly to talk about this movie. First off, I want to introduce, he is the artistic director of Davenport Junior Theater. He's also an actor with multiple credits to his name. You may have seen him in all sorts of different things, and I'll let him talk about that a little bit, but please welcome Ben Gujan. How you doing, Ben?
I'm well, Lou. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on. How are things going with Junior Theater? Anything going on that you want the people to know about?
Yeah, they're going great. We actually just had auditions for our second virtual production of the year. We moved full virtual producing-wise this year and just had auditions for Alice in Wonderland that will be going up in February. And then I'm also currently appearing in Arrowrock Lyceum Theater's virtual Christmas Carol, which premiered last night and also premieres tonight. And I play Bob Cratchit in that.
Fantastic.
So getting a little holiday spirit.
Excellent. All right. And rounding out our panel tonight, we are thrilled to have with us, she's the chair of the Department of Theater at Western Michigan University. She is also a published author who's written several books, including one very pertinent to our discussion today, I Ain't Sorry for Nothing I Done, August Wilson's Process of Playwriting. Please welcome Dr. Joan Harrington. Thank you for joining us, Joan.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here to discuss August's work.
Awesome. Great. How are things going for you? Everything doing okay? And I know academia in COVID times has been interesting. Everything going okay for you?
Everything's going great. We were thrilled to be able to actually have our students in the building. Most of our classes were face-to-face or mask-to-mask this past semester, and we'll do the same. We're producing outside. We produced outside when the weather's good. We'll do that again in the spring, and we're just trying to keep our young artists busy.
Excellent. Well, we do have a traditional question that I'll pose, maybe the toughest question I'll ask for this entire podcast, but anytime we have new guests on the show, we always ask them, what is your favorite movie? So Ben, let's start with you.
Oh my gosh, it really is the toughest question. I mean, to my heart, like I'm a Star Wars generation kid, so I grew up with the original franchise, and they will always hold a near and dear place to my heart, but it's just easier just to say Star Wars than to go into that's a whole podcast to itself.
Perfect. All right, Joan, how about you?
I'm gonna have to go with Casablanca.
Wonderful movie. Yeah.
Long time fan of that one. But, you know, followed closely by maybe Fellini's Ship Sails On, more contemporary first Godfather.
Awesome. Great. All right. Well, let's get into the movie we're talking about today. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom just came out on Netflix on Friday. So what we're going to do here in full disclosure is we're going to spend about 5 to 7 minutes or so just giving you some non-spoilery thoughts about the film, even though it is based on a play from the mid-80s. So if some of you may already be familiar, but we're going to talk about just to give you our general thoughts about it, and then we'll get into a deep dive, which I'm looking forward to. So first impressions, Joan, what did you think of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
I think it's a powerful film and a really good translation of the play. Some really, really stellar performances by almost everyone. Just really across the board, consistently good acting work. Looks great. If you're interested in, you know, art direction in films, they've done a really, really nice job sort of capturing the city. So I think it was a very successful film. It's dark, it's gritty, but a lot good human story.
Excellent. All right, Ben, how about you?
I completely agree. I mean, I thought it was just beautiful to look at. And I'm glad you mentioned the art direction, Joan, because just the texture of the film and so much of the vibrancy of the era and the characters really played out in the way the film looked. And yeah, the performances were just top notch. Like the cast across the board was just really stellar. And when you have writing like August Wilson's writing, it does that much more of the work for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think this is one of the best films I've seen all year. I know there's a lot still to get to, but if this doesn't make my top five or top 10, then this has been an outstanding year for film because I really did enjoy this. And I, like you said, Jen, I really did appreciate the translation from stage to screen, which doesn't always work well. Sometimes things get lost in translation, things don't work, or, you know, the medium is different. So it's just sometimes it doesn't all work. But what I got the sense of in watching this is that there was a great care and concern for the source material here. And it didn't feel like, oh, well, this was some hit play, so we need to do a film version of it. So we just hired a bunch of people. This felt like a group of people coming together to honor a work that they loved. And that, I think, translates to everything. The look of it, I think they expand on the world of the play without, you know, compromising it. I think the language works really well and the performances are outstanding. I know we'll get deeper into all of those, but it's a great ensemble. It's got two powerhouse leads. It's really everything that you kind of want in this kind of a film. And it's got a great, interesting, challenging message to it. I guess great's not necessarily the right terminology, but it certainly has a lot of things to think about and chew on while still being a really entertaining watch is the other thing. Is it's not a film that is heavy-handed or preachy, but there's certainly lots of themes and messages in the film that we'll get into. But yeah, I absolutely recommend that you see the film. It's definitely worth your time. But we're going to leave it at that and just say, you know, I think we're all on the same page here. But I'm really excited to. I want to get to the good stuff. So we're going to go ahead and give the spoiler warning now, and then we're going to go ahead and talk about all of the different scenes and moments and performances. So if you want to not be spoiled on major plot points of the film, this is a good time to pause. Go check the movie out. It's not going to take you that long. The movie's an hour and a half, which was another stunning thing that I noticed about the film. But we'll start spoilers in 3, 2, 1. All right. I think I'd like to start maybe with you, Joan, and talk a little bit about, I know you are a scholar on Wilson's work. Maybe provide our listeners a little bit of a background on this play and where it kind of fits in with Wilson's overall work, and then we can maybe then segue to talk about the adaptation a little bit.
This is one of the first plays that Wilson wrote that became part of his 10-year cycle of plays, one play for every decade in the 20th century. It's actually the second one. The first one was Jitney, but Jitney did not achieve much presence in the theater when it was written. So Ma Rainey sort of stands as the first one that large numbers of audiences got to experience. August first wrote a play that was really just the band members in the band room. Then he decided to add Ma into it, which he did. And in the original drafts of the play, they're two very separate worlds. And as he rewrote them, he blended those worlds together. The play was developed at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut, and then at the Yale Rep, and then it premiered on Broadway in, I think, October of 1984. So it was really the first one. It was really August's, the world's introduction to August, the world at large, the world of theater, in terms of providing him that kind of broad exposure and establishing him as a force that was going to impact American theater significantly.
Okay.
The play got mixed response. There were a lot of people who objected to the fact that it had a bifurcated focus, mm-hmm. And did not like that it went back and forth, which is why he wrote Fences in the way that he did shortly thereafter.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think the film does a good job of blending those two different stories, those two narratives together. But one thing I think, I guess let's talk maybe a little bit about in the adaptation process, some of the differences. I know, you know, one of the big differences is that opening sequence of the film, where we, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but in the original play, we don't see Ma Rainey until halfway through the play. Is that correct?
Yeah, she arrives. It's not quite that far, but she does arrive after we've met all of the band members first. So she comes in sooner in the film. The film does blend the worlds more effectively, and most of what was lost from the original script is lost from the band room. So it balances the play, the movie, a little bit more significantly than the play.
Okay.
But yeah, seeing Ma before she arrives at the studio is a change in the film, establishing her early.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that I thought was so great about just those opening shots is it sets you up like, you know, you've got men running through the woods and torches, and immediately your mind is like, oh my gosh, what's happening here? This is going to be something awful. And then you just arrive at this joyous tent of sweat and heat and music and just people excited. And, you know, it was just such a great setup for the world that Ma comes from.
Right. I think it also really establishes her as an artist in the way that the play does not. The play tells you that she is, but to really see how powerful she is in performance, in live performance. So when she keeps saying, I could go back down south where they love me, I could go back down south where they you've seen that in the play. You haven't witnessed that. You've really seen that. And you're like, yes, I see what it's like for you in that world. So establishing her place there versus her place in the white recording world set up a much more powerful juxtaposition of, and really sets up that piece of text where she says, you know, they just treat me like a whore, and when they're done, they roll over and put their pants on, and I'm just a commodity. I think it really brought that home to have seen what the other part of her world is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was thinking what it does is it allows when Ma stands her ground in the recording studio, we as an audience then understand, oh, it's like, no, she's right.
Yeah.
We like, no, she is a star. And they do such a great job of establishing that star power and be like, yeah, if any other big name recording artist came in, they would want it this way. And this is why that would happen. And then conversely, then it makes Levy's conflict with her, it punctuates it better because it, you know, he is, you know, when you hear his conversations in the beginning, you could maybe sort of, you know, you certainly can sympathize with what he's saying. He's wanting to try to push the art forward. And in the story, you might be willing, you might think, oh, this is about, you know, new generation versus old generation. And typically those stories, it's always the new generation is typically the ones in the right and the old is in the wrong. But in this case, we know that, well, she knows what works and she knows who she is and she knows her worth. So she's not going to let anybody push her around. And that whole opening sequence, I think, really establishes that.
There's also the great scene where she's walking through the hotel, you know, which I think is just a small little creation that lets you see the juxtaposition of the stardom you have just witnessed with her place, again, in quotations, in that hotel.
And just not too far a sidebar from everything, but like thinking about that tent and just that first shot of Ma and the makeup and the teeth, and it was also rich and vivid and, you know, kind of that there's the grease paint and the faded or the, you know, streaked mascara in the eyes. And it was so just like, bam, in your face of this person lives in this world. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where she is home and who she is and a performer. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know sometimes as a performer, like it's easy, like the stage is where we come alive and where we're comfortable. And it's outside the stage where we have to fight for our place. But when you're on the stage and in that place and with your people, you know, that's when you really are able to live.
Yeah. And one of the things that I felt about that too is, and we haven't mentioned the director yet. This is directed by George C. Wolfe, who has some film credits, but is mostly known for his work on the stage. And he's directed some wonderful plays and musicals. And so that's the one thing that I thought this, I think we all come from the theater and we've all read a lot of plays and been and directed and acted in a lot of plays. And one of the things, you know, like I said in the intro was a lot of times you see plays get adapted for film and there feels like there's this need to suck out the theatricality of a piece because they're like, oh, you need to ground it more because it's film and you're doing close-ups and things like that. This movie, heightened might be for the production design. I think there is a heightened element to it, especially like those skyline shots of the city that are just gorgeous to look at, but they don't necessarily look like a real city per se, but they give you that impression. And that smoky tent that you're talking about in the beginning and her makeup, it's all there. There's a theatricality to the film that doesn't ever take a one step too far and become too big for the film. There's a tightrope that Wolf walks here that I think is really remarkable. And in these sequences that you're all talking about, none of these scenes have any dialogue. And so this is another example, I think, of a movie that is giving sequences, adding sequences to an existing script that don't also feel like they were written by somebody else 20 years later, which I think is the other pitfall of adapting plays into film, is that you get a new screenwriter and they want to add their flourish to it or add a couple of extra scenes and then feel displaced or disjointed. And I never got that sense watching this.
Yeah, so
I think that helped that, you know, Ruben Santiago Hudson did the screenplay and he's one of, you know, the preeminent interpreters of August Wilson's work as an actor and as a director. So you knew that he was going to be faithful to August Wilson's vision in the adaptation.
I also wouldn't be surprised if when Constanza Romero, who's the executive producer on the piece, gave permission for them to do it, that there was not an opportunity to include a single word that August hadn't written, which I think is an awesome thing.
Just yes, absolutely.
No. This, you got all this play to work with. You're not writing anything else.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah, which always baffles me sometimes with adaptations. It's like, well, if you're adapting this, presumably you liked the script to start with. You know, we don't need to necessarily reinvent the wheel here. But yeah, that whole opening sequence really sets the tone and the best part, and I guess this will segue into, you know, in talking about some of these characters then, is after you see all of those like beautiful pictures, we are introduced to the band and the band gets put in this waiting room that couldn't look more be a more stark contrast than the beautiful colors and vibrant images that we've seen up to that point. And it's such a great, already just without not having to tell the audience, but just showing them, okay, this is the world these characters have to live in because of the time period that they're in and because of their race. But we get introduced to the band and it's such a beautiful ensemble of actors and they spend most of their time in that rehearsal area. So let's talk a little bit about the performances here. Obviously, we have two leads here in Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman that are getting a lot of discussion about awards and are getting a lot of praise. Well, so let's start me herself. Let's talk about Viola Davis's performance and what stood out to you in terms of her interpretation of this character, Joan.
I think that she brings a fierceness that I actually have not seen quite that level of fierceness in any of the live performances of Ma Rainey that I've seen. You can just see that fire rages inside her all the time. and it doesn't take much for her to feel obligated to just come forward and claim what is rightfully hers. And I think, you know, and then at the same time, the way she also balanced the fatigue of living that way, you know, when she sits down and changes her shoes and just in that moment, just for that moment, you know, maybe when it's just her and her cutler, you know, maybe for a minute she can just be easy, but otherwise never is she not burning. And I thought her balancing of those were just really, really compelling.
Yeah, and there was that fatigue. There was a shot that just stood out to me so much when she's talking with Irvin about Sylvester's money, and she's fighting for Sylvester to get his own money for the recording, and just has that fierceness. And then Irvin leaves the room and she just sinks into her chair and just kind of this exhaustion. And then as soon as he comes back in, like, bam, a switch flips and the fierceness is back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a balancing act that she does of, you know, being such a force of nature and holding her ground on everything. And also, but at the same time, being supportive of the community around her, of her band, of her family, and then which bleeds into her hesitancy to engage with, have much to do with Levy for multiple reasons. And we can talk about that in a minute, but just, you know, the fact that she is somebody who knows her worth, she's going to take care of her people. And, but at the same time, yeah, the mixture of strength and exhaustion, I think, that you both talked about is outstanding. And I think it's absolutely an astonishing performance. And I think there is also the moments where we get to see her singing and the commitment to the songs that I also thought was, you can tell that this is music that Ma Rainey feels. This is music. This is not just a business for her. That and it taps into, I think, one of the great things about this play is it's also kind of it's a love letter to the music of the blues and how much how vital it was and still is that kind of music is an outlet for her, as well as not just professionally but personally as well. Juxtaposed with her then is Chadwick Boseman as Levy, and I, you know, certainly, look, there's an elephant in the room, and I think we, you know, obviously, a lot of reviewers have addressed, you know, the fact that this was released posthumously. We lost Chadwick earlier this year, and so this is, you know, the final performance we'll get to see of him. And I knew it was going to be tough to watch because I've been such a fan of his work, but at the same time, I loved watching it, but it also made me kind of wistful, because this is a performance and a character that I don't think we've really gotten to see out of him in his filmography just yet. And it kind of took me off guard, but thoughts about Chadwick Boseman as Levy, Ben, we'll start with you.
I thought he was just incredible. There was just the way he had that just seething anger kind of underneath everything, but it was balanced with this, just such a passion and a, I'm going to do it. I'm going to climb out of this. And there was something that was so interesting to me that I've kept thinking about the production design. And like, you've got the band in the basement and then Ma on kind of the middle floor, and then the producer and the manager elevated above that. And just kind of this, you know, this tiered class system, you know, and his fight to try to get up to that next level of the building, you know, and even in his conversations with Sturtevant, how he, you know, it's always like trying to get up the stairs, but Sturtevant is blocking him on the stairs and he can't get up those stairs, but just that passion and I'm going to rise out of this, get out of this dingy basement room, you know, coupled with that frustration and that anger of being there. And he was just pitch perfect. He was so good. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of those things where I just don't have the superlatives to describe the way I felt about his performance.
Sure.
Like, it quick, was quick, just quick spot add on what you've said, Ben, about him trying to get out of that band room. the addition of the blocked door, which is not in the play, and his continual trying to get through that door in those moments when he just needs that, and then the final moment where he breaks it open to find that he is at the bottom of that shaft, mm-hmm. was just, I thought, an incredible metaphoric addition to his whole challenge that character faces, just that you've just captured there, Ben, is just that you know, because that's not in the play, that whole, it's like, damn, why don't this door open, right? And yeah, he must keep working at it. And then it finally at the end, when he most needs it to be free of that room, it's worse on the other side.
Yep.
So I thought that was a really brilliant addition. And I thought the performance is extraordinary. And I think what he captures in that really difficult role is the insecurity that pervades that character, even in those moments where he's challenging Toledo or challenging Cutler, that you can just sense that the ground beneath him is not as firm as he would like you to believe that it is. And that's a really layered performance for him to have achieved those, you know, I'm the artist, I have vision, I'm, you know, have this energy for that. I have all this anger. And then underneath it all is this incredible uncertainty that I thought is the most difficult part of that role to achieve. And I thought he really captured it. And that really allows you to have compassion for him.
Mm-hmm. You know, just there's that continual sense, I think, when you're a young artist trying to break out of, I know I can do this. Can I do this? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, that struggle of having the confidence in yourself, but there's all those underlying doubts of, can I make it?
Well, and combined with the cockiness of youth, of not only can I do this, I can do this without anyone. I can do this all on my own, which I think was the one thing that struck me about his character. And I mentioned when we talked about Ma Rainey is that, you know, Ma Rainey is a character is, you know, could on the surface be viewed as hard to work with or demanding, but yet she takes care of everyone around her. She creates a community around her of artists, she brings her family member in, even though he clearly is out of his element being on a record. And the one person she takes issue with is the one person who doesn't ascribe to that communal effort, to that collaborative effort. And he comes in and he tells all the other band members, I've got talent, I'll be fine. I don't need you guys. Which then, you know, extrapolates to a larger message that, you know, I think Wilson's making in the play, or, you know, in this case, in the film about it. And it's something that Toledo talks about early in the play about, or in the film, I'm going to interchange that term throughout this, is I've been talking about it as a play and it's only been a movie for about a week, so forgive me. But when Toledo talks about, you know, all the need for community and the need for everyone to all be on the same page, for all Black people to be on the same page about, you know, what, and that the youth was too concerned about having fun or things like that. So there's a mix of that, you know, kind of, you know, cockiness that we ascribe to youth, but also then, you know, the dark layer underneath that's simmering under the surface that then explodes. And I think the casting of Chadwick Boseman is so perfect for that, because if you weren't familiar with the play and you're like, well, here's Chadwick Boseman, who's, you know, typically played, heroic figures, literally and figuratively, and he comes in and he is charming and he is easy to watch. He's so charismatic that you would only think, oh, I'm supposed to, I don't know, side is the right issue, but I'm supposed to see the story from his point of view. And then when it shifts as the story unfolds, it's really kind of a good turn that you wouldn't expect, just if you only knew this work from the film and from the choice to cast Chadwick Boseman. So let's talk a little bit about the the rest of the ensemble. We're not going to be able to hit every single person, but I'm glad we dug in a little bit on the first two. Let's talk about the ensemble as a whole, and maybe we'll talk about the band. We have the three other band members. We have Coleman Domingo as Cutler, Glenn Turman as Toledo, and Michael Potts as Slowdrag. Anything in particular that you want to highlight or talk about with those three actors?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, Glenn Turman is what was known as a Wilsonian, which was that generation, a collection of actors who, when August's work first started to be done, Ma Rainey and Fences and Piano Lesson and Joe Turner, there was a group of actors who did the plays all the time, all over the country. And they became the Wilsonians. Viola is sort of the second generation because she's been in a couple of plays and films. But Glenn is one of the last surviving Wilsonian actors, so it was really lovely that he got to do the film. I actually think Denzel had saw him do the part in LA, I think at the Mark Taper Forum, and went backstage and said, hey, you know, hold some time on your calendar because I got a job for you. But I thought it was just really a lovely thing that he got to return to the work in this new format. And I just think he really, more than anyone else in the film, and maybe because he's done so much work, captures that condition of talk that pervades August's work, where you just have something to say and you're not in any hurry to say it, and it's going to be a significant story. That character probably suffered the most cutting from the play to the film because of it, but just his ability to just tell those stories and your willingness to just sit there and listen to him talk all day long.
I think that my feeling about his performance was it just felt so lived in, you know, just so easy and natural. And I mean, my favorite moment of the movie was his monologue where he's sitting at the piano and just kind of tinkering around on the piano and talks about the stew and the black man being the leftovers. Like, it was just such a beautiful moment. And there was there's so much musicality in Wilson's writing anyways, but there were moments like that. And when a little earlier, when they were talking about having a good time and Slowdrag is on the bass under it, like the way the filmmakers incorporated that musicality into moments of the film were really just beautiful. But that monologue that Turman did about the leftovers and the stew just hits you. It's just so poignant for what he's talking about and how he delivers it so easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the heart of his character, I mean, he really is kind of the heart of that band of artists. And you know, they pick on him a little bit, and he takes it all in this good nature. I think lived in's a great word, because there's just an effortlessness in his performance. And I think sometimes, you know, obviously when you have your two main characters who have some just very fiery moments and big, powerful, you know, monologues and speeches, sometimes we look at those things and then we forget, you know, just how hard it can be to just be natural in those moments and effortless on screen. And I think, you know, like what you said, Joan, in him, you know, knowing Wilson's work as well and having such experience with it, just kind of knowing that language and the rhythms and being able to just kind of slip into that character so naturalistically, you'd be forgiven if you were like, well, he's not, doesn't feel like he's doing that, but he's doing so much. And he's also, because he's not the focus of the story, he's providing like a heart to the ensemble without like overstepping or overshadowing the leads. I thought Coleman Domingo as Cutler was outstanding. I thought there's not a bad performance in this movie. I guess I should just, you know, as opposed to somebody else who we're going to get to and rip on for 20 minutes now. But I guess I just wanted to mention, I thought his interactions, particularly with Chadwick's Levy, were always, there was this really lovely mix of tension and camaraderie with the two of them. that never, you know, until we get to the end of the play, that like they're clearly at different, you know, they have different philosophical takes on the world. But I thought that Coleman seemed to, as Cutler seemed to feel like he knew, he understood what was going on in the world, and he understood, okay, this is where I need to be. And his trying to maybe mentor Levy a little bit, I thought that provided an interesting dynamic. Any thoughts on his performance?
Again, a solid, you know, powerful performance, balancing that, his place in the band as the peacekeeper, the try and make everything work. You know, you can see he has a little bit more influence, a little bit more of a relationship with Ma that he can play. And I thought he played well, that he will tolerate Levy except when Levy challenges him on the things that cannot be challenged for him, his faith, that at that point they can no longer live in the same world. Mm-hmm. So that makes it a really powerful moment, because he does have that nice even keel quality until he is pushed just a little bit too far. And we see that breaking point in him. And I think that fear in him, because that's really, I think, coming from a place of fear, because he needs that faith.
Yeah, faith is such an interesting theme in the play, and you know, something that the belief in God or Levy's faith, which he basically has no faith, is such an interesting kind of subplot that we touch on. And that's one of the things, again, what's fascinating about this work is, again, as we mentioned earlier, it's a very short piece. It's, you know, it's a 90-minute film, but there's so much like going on in the film that I think we could probably sit and talk way longer than the length of the film, which we're not going to do, but we could. And the idea of faith and how that presents itself to all of these different people, and how, you know, Levy challenges the notion of faith because of everything that he's been through, but yet, you know, I guess the interesting thing is he never really asks. One would assume these other characters have all been through, maybe not exactly what Levy has been through, but have all been through hardships of their own. And Levy never takes the time to acknowledge, okay, I've been through, you know, he's been through some stuff and he has a reason for not having faith. We never really dive into Cutler's faith or just to know that that's his breaking point. But I know faith is also a big theme in a lot of Wilson's works. So maybe as we're talking about it, how it pertains to Ma Rainey, but maybe just to Wilson in general, how does faith manifest itself in a lot of Wilson's works, Joan?
Well, I'm going to back up and say that I don't know that Levy is a man who does not have faith. I think he's a man who does not have faith in the white Christian God. Mm. And I think that's very different.
Sure.
Okay. And I think that's a theme that you see a lot. You see it in Loomis, Joe Turner's Come and Gone. But the question of whether people of African descent have abandoned their own faith and their own gods and their own traditions to take on the white Christian faith with a very white God is pervasive in all of Wilson's work. And I think that's really where Levy is coming in. So not so much a man of no faith, but a man who questions faith in a God who maybe is not the right God for him. So I think I'm going to make that little bit of differentiation.
Sure.
And the art, you know, Wilson frequently looks at, you know, you can't move forward if you don't acknowledge your past. And I think that gives Levy kind of a lost place. He doesn't hear what Toledo says about past and connection, as you pointed out, to community. And so that leaves him in a really difficult place of neither here nor there, in sort of a netherland. But questioning faith, the intersection of non-Christian traditions with Christian traditions is in a lot of Wilson's work. But whether or not, you know, a God who, you know, why hast thou forsaken me? And how you continue to worship that God or believe that God is omnipotent is, I think, the questioning that I think that Wilson intends that we hear what Levy has to say and that we think about what Levy has to say, that where, what type of God allows those things to happen, and is that then my God?
Okay.
Very late. It's a very 20th century argument anyway, right? In terms of like, how did God let the Holocaust happen, or how did, you know, in lots of times when lots of people believe, you know, and, but it's a reframing, a reconciliation of a very encapsulated doctrine that I think he's saying, you know, I can't do that. I can't pray to that. I can't pray to that, that man, right? Mm-hmm. Who lets that preacher have his, you know, have his Bible ripped up, have his cross ripped off his neck, you know, who, but I think, you know, who also plays, if you look at, you know, Rose in Fences, or even, you know, Toledo's wife, Wilson also has a lot to say about people who give over 100% to a church, and what that takes from them. That's also a recurring theme. It's not quite as prominent in this one, but it does come in with the story of, you know, Toledo losing his wife to the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and we see with, you know, Slow Drag's got the story about the guy who sold his soul to the devil. And, you know, that idea keeps coming back. Levy's talking earlier about, like, death is sexy. Like, that's a God I can get behind. I'll sell my soul to the devil any minute. So there is a faith there, but again, not maybe that white Christian God, because like you said, Joan, that God has forsaken Levy in his eyes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So why do I go there? I'm going to go over here.
And we've created that God out of a Middle Eastern savior.
Right. Coming next week on the podcast.
Coming next week, right.
We solve religion.
As we come to Christmas, we're just going to bring that up.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's such an interesting thing, and we could talk about just even that aspect, but I think obviously we'd be remiss if we didn't get to kind of maybe the crux of the conflict and ultimately the resolution and what that means for what Wilson, I think, was looking for in to say in this piece. So we'll just you know, because I want to make sure we get this in, is, so you know, throughout the course of the film, we see Levy kind of wanting to become a solo artist. We see Ma hesitant. We obviously, there's kind of a love triangle that we haven't really gotten to talk about with the character of Dussie May, but what culminates ultimately is that Ma fires Levy from the band. Levy doesn't seem to care because he thinks he's got these songs he's going to sell to Sturdivant. Sturdivant gives him $5 for the songs, but he doesn't let him record it. So, you know, Levy is left with nothing. He's got no venue to ply his craft. He's got no, you know, he viewed music as his way out. That's now taken from him. And ultimately, he comes back in such a rage and anger that he, you know, Toledo steps on his shoe, and that is the last straw. And in a fit of rage, he stabs Toledo and kills him. So I want to lay that groundwork just to maybe talk into what we think some to talk about maybe some of the bigger themes at play in the film and what Wilson was. Maybe trying to say with this piece. Joan, I'll let you start.
Oh, well, that's a big question, but if we're going to focus specifically on the you know, the exchange with Sturdivant, you know, for, it's just really echoing what was not available to these artists, starting with respect, that Levy is so taken advantage of. And it's sort of that great moment, and it's also beautifully filmed, where he's on the steps and you know that the band can hear the whole exchange. And so when he comes in, I think it's not only anger, but it's just profound humiliation. And I think that's what Ma consistently feels, which is why she needs to keep rising up and establishing her place. And that just exploring that consistent effort to keep the black man down, to take what you need from him or from her, legitimately or illegitimately, because Sturdivant is clearly doing him wrong when he buys those songs. And we can talk about the ending of the film, which is not the ending of the play. Mm-hmm. But just that, what that does to the soul of a man, right? Mm-hmm. What that does to his soul, how that just is just that humiliation, that betrayal, that lack of respect is just not survivable for him. And it just results in that extraordinary act of violence because he cannot do anything else.
Yeah, and he's poured his heart out earlier in, you know, that monologue about what happened to his mother and his father, and, you know, talking about, I know how to deal with the white man. What? You're laughing at me saying yes, sir, and you're laughing at me, you know, dancing, but I know how to deal with it. And then when that moment comes, he just gets, here's $5, go away.
You know? And then when that happens, he takes it out on his bandmates, his community. He takes the slight and the shame from that was given to him by this other guy. He doesn't take it out on him. He comes back and he fuels that rage back towards people who don't deserve it. And moreover, were people who, had he been open and supportive of him. And I think that's an interesting commentary itself, in terms of, we talk about, you know, and this play was written in 1984, but there's, you know, it's hard not to watch this with a 2020 mindset, you know, films made in 2020. So, you know, obviously there's modern day parallels, and we can talk about, you know, violence in all sorts of permutations of it, but how, you know, violence within communities oftentimes is the result of things that have happened to the people within those communities by people who aren't in that community. I think that's a powerful message too, that, you know, again, it's not told to us, it's shown to us in a really powerful way.
I had just been having this conversation earlier today that is going to seem like a total non sequitur, but I used to manage a restaurant, and you'd have people come in and get irrationably angry about their broccoli. It's like, they're not really that mad about the broccoli. It's something outside that's coming in, and that anger is getting channeled to the broccoli. And it's that exact same thing. There are these outside forces pressing on him, and he takes it out on the thing that's in front of him, you know, which is Toledo and the show.
You know, complicating the anger is a powerlessness that comes from oppression. And, you know, the affront is that, you know, Toledo steps on his shoe, right? And it's just, he just needs to somehow feel powerful. And he, you know, and even though Toledo apologizes, he cannot pull from him enough edification that he is of his own self-worth. So the only thing he can do to feel powerful is the most awful thing that he can do, is to take to Toledo's life, just to empower himself. And then again, returning to the humiliation in the closing line that he says to him, which is, don't look at me like that, right? Don't judge me, is the last thing that he can say to Toledo.
Yeah. It's just such a powerful moment. There's so much that we could talk about and dissect and bring in. But it's really, again, it's a masterful writer that can have all of those things going on in a scene that is, you know, 4 or 5 minutes long, and he doesn't go on this long monologue about why he feels this way, but it's all there in this, you know, concise storytelling. And the other thing that we didn't bring onto it, it's the oppression that they're feeling is also kind of characterized by the oppressive heat that keeps happening in the story, which is another, it harkens to one of my favorite movies, Do the Right Thing, where it's just this, you know, tensions on the hottest day of the year, and eventually, you know, there's a tragedy and everything erupts. And while, you know, you certainly, you don't want to diminish the social issues that are undercurrent, you're also like, okay, part of it is like what you said, Ben, it's everything. It's the combination of all these elements. And then, you know, you're mad about this last thing happens, and then things spiral to a place that you can't really recover from. And we don't ever see, you know, that's the end of the play, but it's not the end of the film. We learn that Levy does, you know, we don't learn much about Levy, but we know that the only thing we do learn about Levy is what happens to his song. And I think that's, it's an interesting choice to see that his song that was bought by Sturdivant for $5 then gets sold and performed by an all-white band with an all-white singer in a way that has, it's such a great juxtaposition to the opening song that we see that is so vibrant and full of life. And this version is so static and bland. But again, it was not something that was in the original play. I guess maybe get your thoughts on the addition of that final scene, Joan.
Well, you know, in the play you have that ambiguous moment when Sturdivant, you know, buys the songs, but the way the text is written, you pretty much know as an audience member that it's a dishonest moment, right? You know, he says, I can't do anything, but I'll do this nice thing, because it's, Sturdivant is not a nice man. Sturdivant wouldn't give him $5, you know what I mean? He just needs to do that so he could, so you sense that, but there's this ambiguity there. But I, you know, so there's no ambiguity at the end of the film, but it's also such a friend of mine described it as like a cringe-worthy moment, that at the end of the movie, you just as an audience go, ugh. Right, you have just one last, if you didn't get it before, if you didn't feel what he wanted you to feel, right, they're just gonna make sure at the end of the movie that you go, that you just feel that the world, how you know, what the world really is, mm-hmm. and it makes you uncomfortable and it makes you unhappy. And I think it's a really powerful choice for the end of the movie that way. And I think also to back up for a second, you know, really interesting, brilliance of the writing, brilliance of the performance and the filmmaking. In the moment when Levy stabs Toledo, you feel bad for Levy. Mm-hmm. Right? Which I think is a really amazing moment. And then that carries you through. You're already feeling badly for him. And then you see that last scene where they're singing his song. And now you're just like, I thought it was a great choice.
Yeah, it really made me wonder, like, what happens to Levy after the film? Like, does he just run out? Does he get caught? Does he live his life on the run after that? Or?
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, we know that, you know, his music has been, everything's been taken from him. His, mm-hmm. his songwriting has been taken from him. His performance has been taken from him. He, you know, you would be left to assume that, you know, I don't know if he would go to jail or anything like that. And I guess that, you know, the important part is necessarily, you know, we're not meant to dwell on it. We're meant to think, okay, he's got nothing. And what little he had that meant so much to him was sold for $5 to be given to people who didn't understand the music and just, you know, made it completely ineffective art and in, you know, this bland music that you know, no one could hear that song and be like, oh, that's a great song. But yeah, I was kind of curious to get your thoughts, because, you know, it is, we talked at the beginning about, you know, the not adding to Wilson's dialogue, but clearly that button that they put on it at the end is something that really does drive a point home that isn't in the play. But yeah, it also then ties back into what we know about so many blues artists from that era who were major stars and were left penniless because of their publishers who gave them, you know, so much for one song to sing some songs, but they didn't own their songs. They didn't own their recordings. And so many wonderful blues artists die penniless because their record companies didn't take care of them, because they didn't see them as anything other than performers and not as humans, which is something that Ma talks about earlier in the play. And I think, you know, the sense of self-worth, I think, is one is something that I just, you know, keep going back to when talking about this play, is knowing your worth and fighting for that worth in a system, in a society that doesn't value you, is something I think that is so vital to this piece. And I'm glad we got to see it.
The one other thing that really struck me was, you know, and I know, Joan, you've written about this a lot, but the Wilson's writing with Romare Bearden's paintings and how the inspiration in that, but just like the color saturation of the art direction, you know, was very, it just made me think of his collages and the way kind of some of the, like the scenes and the music were pieced together, like with Toledo's Leftover monologues and the Good Times monologues. There was at some times in the filmmaking, like this collage-esque quality, two things that I just thought was interesting. You know, I don't know that there's a whole lot to say on it, but sure. It was like, oh, I really appreciate that I can at least make a little tie to that Wilson connection.
Right. All right, Joan, how about you? Anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
No, I just, you know, appreciate that the filmmakers were brave in giving us a film that we can just sit in, right? That, you know, it doesn't race forward. They weren't impatient in making it, and that enables me to be patient and just revel in it as I watch it. You know, it's permission to say, here, this is a gift, just experience it. It's a film, I think, that you really experience if you let yourself, and in every way, sensorily, I mean, in you know, visually and orally, with the music, as Ben pointed out, and the visuals, as Ben just pointed out, it's just a really rich experience for the film goer. And we don't have a lot of that in contemporary filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we do. Came from a bunch of people who were really not filmmakers, you know, right, as career choices.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Ben, did you have something?
Oh, I was just gonna say, like, you know, and obviously prepping for this, but like I've watched it 3 times now, and it's just, it is that you can just be in it, mm-hmm. you know, it really brings you into that world. And it's so hard to make a film where the majority of the action takes place in one room. Mm-hmm. And they just did such a great job of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also, as kind of what you were pointing out, Joan, it's interesting to see a story that doesn't write out and tell you it's a conflict first, you know, 15, 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
It really doesn't reveal itself until, you know, about almost a third of the way through the film. But in the meantime, you're learning so much about these characters. And I certainly, you know, I've been watching several of the big touted, prestige, quote unquote, movies this season. I know more about these characters in the first 40 minutes than I think I knew about like any of the Hillbilly Elegy characters after 2.5 hours. And so, you know, it's just, I didn't get to be on that podcast, so I'm just slipping in my grievances now, but I'm using it as an example because, yeah, it's such, when writing is that good, you can learn so much about characters without being just force-fed a bunch of exposition, and you like, oh, I want to spend time with these characters, and I enjoyed spending time with them, and then, you know, ultimately that investment pays off at the end when everything comes to a head. So yeah, I don't think we have any, but I do want to say, are there any critiques of the film, any criticisms, anything that you wish could have been a little different or better, or anything before we wrap it up? I don't have any.
the only thing that was that you're like, oh, maybe I would have handled this differently was, you know, Wolf chose to kind of show the northern migration, like just through posting the newspaper articles up there. And that seemed a little out of place for me, but that's a real small.
Yeah, you know, I think he actually did that because it's an homage to the foreword that Wilson wrote to the play, which talks about the migration and what happened when they arrived in the big city. So I think that's why it's in there, but I agree that the film could have stood without it. But
yeah, that's a tiny, tiny, like 20 seconds of film.
At least we came up with something, right?
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, no. So I guess the last thing I wanna is I know we have a lot of listeners who may be more into film than they are to theater, and maybe are fairly new to Wilson's work. So if this is a movie that got people that get people excited about the writings of August Wilson, where would you recommend? What would you recommend next? Obviously, we know he's got, you know, he has a litany of plays, but what do you think that the next, if this is entry level for people on August Wilson, where would you say they should go next?
I'll go for Piano Lesson.
Okay.
The Piano Lesson, I think, is a great follow-up to this in terms of similar structures, long storytelling. You know, I think that's a good one to go to. Joe Turner's Come and Gone is my personal favorite.
Yeah, Joe Turner's my personal favorite too, which ties in a lot with the, you know, the aspects of faith and religion we were talking about earlier. One random moment in the film that I just remembered that really jumped out at me is when Toledo's talking about the leftovers, they just kind of have some shots of random people. And the first guy they showed looked so much like a young James Earl Jones. And I wondered, was that a very conscious choice to, you know, show him as kind of this little nod to Troy and Fences? It was just it seemed like a little quick wink that I just really loved.
Yeah.
Good news for filmgoers is that Denzel Washington has committed himself to producing all 10 in the cycle. And it wasn't that much time that passed in between Fences and Ma Rainey. So I think there'll be another one before too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you haven't seen Fences yet, if this is your first Wilson, definitely check out Fences.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think those are all great recommends. And yeah, and certainly with the reception of this film, hopefully it will be sooner than later that we get them. I know Denzel Washington's an incredibly driven human being, so I think he's got the sway to make that happen. So I haven't heard which one he's going to next, if there's an order or aside from, but yeah, no, I'm excited that more people are getting to discover this through film and through Netflix, which also was another thing that I think one of the benefits of the situation that we're in is that this movie is now available to everybody to see right now. And I absolutely recommend that you see it. Also, Netflix has also released a 30-minute behind the scenes documentary of it. Some supplemental material too, just because look, the movie's not that long. You could watch the movie behind the scenes and still like not even be halfway through The Irishman. So, you know, so definitely it's worth checking out. I want to thank you both for coming on. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lou.
Yeah, this was wonderful. Before we let you go, are there any other projects or social media that you want the listeners to be aware of now after they've heard you talk? Because I want more of these people. Where can I find them? Nothing? Okay.
I've been watching the Unabomber series, so in a cabin in the woods.
Okay, fair. All right. Well, as always, you can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hair. You can go to NPR Illinois. And on our Community Voices tab, you will find links to all of our latest podcasts. I know we're getting into Oscar season, so we're going to have all sorts of award stuff, but we've also got some pretty big new releases coming out, released on Christmas Day. We have Wonder Woman 1984. We've had Soul. I know we're going to get full disclosures on those. I know later this week, you're going to hear my thoughts on The Godfather, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. We're going to revisit that and talk about the changes that were made to that film and whether or not they made the film better or worse. We're going to get all into that. And also, if you're still in that holiday spirit, you can go back into my feed, Guilty Pleasures, and find my trilogy of Netflix Christmas movies that we did, which a month ago, which feels like a decade ago now. But we talked Princess Switch 2, Christmas Chronicles 2, and Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square. outstanding times for everybody. And we've got all sorts of stuff coming up in January. So the way that you can find out about all those things is to follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z, or on Facebook at the Front Row Network. You can find links to all of our shows. Please like and subscribe, share with whoever you think might be interested. And also you can go to Patreon and help support us. We have opened a Patreon in this year, and we are still working towards getting that and getting some exclusive content. I know one of the things you'll get from me is my reaction to the recent trailer release of Coming to America. I feel like I have to like emphasize the two, because when you say it, it just sounds like I'm talking about
Coming to America.
1988. Yeah, Coming to America. I'm gonna react to a trailer to a 1988 film. But that's exclusive over on Patreon.
I'd pay to see it, Lou.
Fantastic. And if you want to pay to see it, come to Patreon and you'll get that kind of exclusive content and all sorts of other stuff. I know we've got some cool stuff coming up in the new year. I hope everybody's doing well. I hope you've had a wonderful, restful holiday season, and above all, a safe one. I hope the new year is wonderful for everybody. I hope you're being safe, wearing your damn masks, washing your damn hands, and enjoying some of these movies with us, and we'll be back to talk about all sorts of different things in the new year. But until next time, on behalf of Dr. Joan Harrington for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Ben Goujon.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.